Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to the Political Party. Today's guest is Steve Rotherham, the Metro Mayor for Liverpool, who's standing for a third term. Polling day, of course, on the 2nd of May. When you listen to this, that will be in just a few days' time. So I hope you've registered to vote and I've voted by post because I got a postal vote a few years ago because of the line of work I'm in. You never know where you're going to be. Obviously, given the amount of time I had in hospital, I wasn't entirely sure when an election would be or whether I'd be inside for that. So I've already voted. I've already had that through. I do slightly miss going to a polling booth and putting the slip into the box and just giving it a little tap. Which I think it's because you see politicians do that on the news in international elections. It also feels like you're just wishing that vote well. A big day for elections on the 2nd of May. And then whoever knows when the general election's going to be. This was recorded on Friday the 26th of April. So if anything has happened in Scottish politics over the weekend, that will not be reflected in this. But I will. I'm going to try and record a bonus Scottish episode available to listeners worldwide, depending on what's happened there. So that will come. But Steve Rotherham was a Labour MP and was Jeremy Corbyn's parliamentary private secretary, former bricklayer. We talk about that. And just, you know, what's really interesting about this is sometimes with an interview, you think it's going to be about a particular thing. So I was really keen to talk about the powers he's got and what he can do and what he's delivered. But also, as this goes on, you realise so much of politics is about identity. And I think that's so true of somewhere like Liverpool. And this is about not just how the authorities and people in power have viewed Liverpool. And we could all think, of course, of notable events where that's been the case to Liverpool's detriment. But also how Liverpool views itself and the politics and the identity of Liverpool. So this is great fun as well, because he's a huge character, Steve Rotherham. And you really, what's really interesting about this is those politicians who weren't front bench, and then either they get a front bench brief or they become a Metro Mayor, and you really start to see their talent and their abilities. And that's what's great about this is the difference between interviewing someone when they were an MP and the difference between interviewing them when they've got, in Steve's case, one of the most powerful people in British politics, a brief with a huge amount of influence and power and money that you can spend, then you see the difference that effectively holding a higher office makes. So this is absolutely brilliant, very enjoyable, highly entertaining. I do have to warn you, there's a slight crackle that we have done everything we can. The boffins at political party headquarters have done their best to eliminate any crackle whatsoever, but there was just a slight issue with the audio, so I apologise for that in advance. I hope it doesn't detract from the quality chat that I think any technical issues will melt away once you enjoy this great chat with Steve Rotherham. Steve, you're seeking a third term as the elected Metro Mayor of Liverpool. Or exactly what the Metro Mayor of the Liverpool City Region, or what is the exact job title?
Yeah, because there is some confusion, of course, because we had a mayor and a mayoral model in the city of Liverpool long before we had a Metro Mayor's, and legislation that came out in 2016, wasn't it? So, yeah, that's why I'm described, I think, uniquely as being a Metro Mayor, whilst the others are called mayors of the city region.
But you had also been the Lord Mayor before.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was a great job. That's like, you know, going round and opening things and cutting ribbons, and everybody thinks you're brilliant. And really, it's just a pleasure, isn't it, to represent your area.
I mean, usually people who are Lord Mayors are, it's councillors who are at the end of their career. It's a ceremonial role. It's a nice gig for them to get, often on the way out, often in their final term or final year. You must have been doing that really at the start of your political career.
I think what happened was, and I still believe that I was the youngest Lord Mayor at the time, the Lib Dems, not brilliant at counting, didn't realise that when you have 2 years of a Lib Dem, because they had twice as many members as us, and 1 year of a Labour Lord Mayor, that the year that we already had identified in that sequence was going to be 2008. In 2008, Liverpool City was European capital of culture. And they clicked onto it a bit too late and then thought that they could announce something, and we pre-announced them. So it was a bit too late. And then once everybody was bandying the name around, then I became the Lord Mayor during the best year that we've ever had. It was just incredible.
I mean, it must be such an immense pleasure and privilege for you to have been a councillor in Liverpool, a member of Parliament, and now Metro Mayor and seeking a third term. Liverpool obviously has made a great contribution to the history of the country and culturally, obviously, to the world, particularly in terms of music. When you were growing up, did you ever imagine that you would have held so many important positions in the story of your city?
It's just like you, Matt, and lots of other people. If somebody had told you where you'd end up in life, you would laugh, wouldn't you? And especially as if you come from a sort of working class background, you expected and managed in some situations not to have aspirations of sort of being an MP, for instance. You know, I used to sit in the House of Commons, as you know, and I sat up, I was a 2010 intake, I sat opposite Jacob Rees-Mogg, and I said to him one day, I said, your mum and dad must be absolutely devastated, given that they threw all the money at your education that you could possibly have, you know, the best schooling and all that, and you've ended up working in the same place as a bricklayer from Kirby. And not that he really fully appreciated that, but that's the sort of thing, isn't it? You don't expect people who've been apprentices to end in the House of Commons, but the question should be, why not?
And how did you feel in there? I mean, some working class people who end up there say that they find it intimidating, and also that almost that it's designed to intimidate. Other people don't. I mean, I've never been an MP, but I always loved the building and the history of it. I never had to stand on the floor of the House of Commons, but I always felt like it was a great place to do politics. I don't know how you felt.
Well, if anybody hasn't been in the chamber, and before I was elected, I'd never been in the chamber of the House of Commons. So the first time I walk into it, I'm looking around and I'm thinking, wow, look at this place. And it's sort of the opposite of the TARDIS, isn't it? It looks big when you see it on the telly, and then when you get in there, it's very, very tight and almost claustrophobic. And I don't know whether it's true about that two sword lengths and all that, you know, where the distance between both sets of parties across the floor is. But I've always found that, yeah, quite intimidating, to tell you the truth. And look, lots of people that I've spoken with have got that imposter syndrome. You know, what am I doing in here? But that's, I think the working class people are the only ones, aren't they, who have this. You know, if you're middle class, your aspiration is to do something like that. If you're upper class, then you're born into it. So the working class people that we see in Parliament, whatever their accent is, wherever they're from in the country, I always think, you know, good on you, because you are doing something that not a lot of people get the opportunity to do.
There was a period of time, obviously, where, I mean, you get elected in 2010, arguably the worst year to come in as a Labour MP, because then you've got the longest period of opposition stretching out in front of you, and it looks like that might end soon. But yeah. Lots of talented people like yourself, Sadiq Khan, Andy Burnham, and people from other parties felt that maybe Parliament wasn't the place to get things done, particularly as a Labour person, to be fair. Yeah. And that now it was about seeking election with these new Metro mayors and elected mayoral roles that gave you unprecedented powers to achieve things. now it looks like Labour might win the next general election. Is there part of you that thinks, in a way, you should have stuck around and then you could have been part of a Labour government?
Oh, no, no, definitely not. I think I can do far more for the area that I love. You might be able to disdain a slight Scouse accent. So I'm from these parts. I know when I was down there, it's probably much more Estuary English now. But I genuinely think that the opportunities to represent the areas that you love and that you can actually exercise real power in trying to reshape, in some cases like ours, or to shape the destiny in other areas of those particular metro mayoral boundaries, I just think it's a brilliant chance. Who wouldn't love to do something positive for the area that they love?
And what sort of impact can you have as a metro mayor? Obviously, when you talk about devolution, every devolved institution wants more powers, and I'm sure you would want more powers to improve the lives of people in the mayoral region that you cover. But already it feels like you've got quite a significant amount of influence over what happens.
Yeah, look, we've been able to, first of all, change the narrative about what Liverpool, and that's the brand Liverpool, and the city region are about, because we've all seen those negative stereotypes. And I found that when you go abroad and you say you're from Liverpool or Liverpool City region, everybody wants to speak to you because they know it and they recognise it's a brilliant brand internationally and globally. But we've always had a problem in Westminster. And when I went down there, I felt that was the case. And we needed to ensure that we were at the top table during discussions so that we could have adult discussions about or debates about what was happening here. And that meant that I had to work with the Tory government. And so we went down there and did all the hard yards to change that. And if you think about whether that was successful or not, can you remember, Matt, which area was chosen to trial mass testing during the pandemic? Well, it was our area. And you have to ask yourself why that was. And it's because we told the government that we would act in a certain way. We did, even though it was Boris Johnson I had to deal with, and I hated every minute of it. But then they then recognised that we were serious about what we needed to do to tackle that in our area. And then that could be spread across the whole of the UK.
So there you are. I mean, we talk about imposter syndrome and working class backgrounds and everything and political differences. And you're someone on the left of the Labour Party from a working class background, finding yourself dealing with the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and whatever your political differences, whatever the differences in your background, whatever the differences in tone, in the way that you conduct yourself in public office, you were actually able to work together in a pragmatic way.
Yeah, and you know, the proof of that is what we were able to achieve. You know, we seen a huge spike in the Liverpool City region. I mean, huge. It was the third highest in the whole of Europe at one stage in the R rate, and we needed to get that down. And I had to work practically with Number 10, mainly with Ed Lister, to tell you the truth, and he was more believable and I think more trustworthy than Mr. Johnson. But you still had to do it. And I really detested Johnson before having to do all of that. And my thoughts have never changed on him, that he's an absolute shyster and he should have never been the Prime Minister of the country. I mean, why we pick a game show host to run the country during the most important moment in 100 years with a pandemic is beyond me. But I had to do that, and I had to convince them that we were serious in working collaboratively, and that's what we did.
And when did he come in? When he say, "Oh, come on, Steve, I know we got these vaccines, we got to get them into arms, whatever it is, Liverpool, the Wirral, or wherever it is, you and Andy Burnham, you socialists in the north of England." Would you have much direct interaction with him, and was it like that?
It was very much like that, except that it wasn't working with Andy Burnham, because what he tried to do, as you know, if you've read a book called Head North, you would know about this, because me and Burnham wrote down some of the memoirs from that period. And it was very, very difficult. Greater Manchester had been in lockdown for, I think, about 12 weeks in the highest tier. And then they introduced this new tier, and we went into that new tier. And they said, because we were into this new tier, we could get some support. So we negotiated a package of support, which was, you know, in all honesty, really helpful, because a lot of the visitor economy had closed down. Well, it's all closed down, but I mean, it was really in danger, and we were propping it up. For Andy, though, who came to Manchester, that 12 weeks of lockdown, he said, oh no, that was the highest tier then. Ooh, we've got a higher one now, so we're not going to consider that period. And all you're getting is from you, when you go into this new artificial tier that is introduced, and quite raggedy, you know, Andy said, on your bike. And we ended up doing something that, first of all, I think saved people going to hospital and therefore saved lives. And we were able to do that. And then we were able to support our Indigenous business community. And that helped us to come out of the pandemic. But what the Tories did was play politics during a time of national crisis. And I don't think that's ever forgivable.
You and Andy Burnham wrote a book together, as you say. You also, a few months ago, had a DJ battle. So was there a victor? And if so, was it a fair victory?
I think there was a victor, and it'll be the one who's got two thumbs pointing towards him if this is ever broadcast. Andy doesn't like getting beat at anything. I'm not just in a DJ battle. We played footy together, and I'm a centre-half, he's a centre-forward, and I kicked him all over the park, so he hated it. He just doesn't like going head-to-head with me. But the likes of the DJ battle, it was great because it was an enjoyable type of event, but it was to raise money for homelessness. And people don't realise that you can do things that are a bit off the radar or unusual, but it's for a really good cause as well. And there were people saying, oh, why don't you get on with your day job and all sorts of stuff? And you think, it's so negative, isn't it? Especially social media, it's so negative. And yet we raised, I think, 30,000 pounds for homelessness charities. And they had said that's a godsend at this moment in time, given the huge increase that we've seen in homelessness people and people sleeping rough.
And I mean, this DJ battle then, it's between two people from Liverpool. I know he is, you know, he represents Manchester electorally, but there must have been rules on how many Beatles records you could play.
Oh, you don't have to play a Beatles record. My goodness me. We are the UK capital of music. If you have a look at UNESCO designated us as a UK city of music, that's Liverpool. But if you look wider from over the Wirral, some of the most famous songs going, you know, Valerie and all that sort of stuff. That wasn't Amy Winehouse, that was the Scouser in...
that was the Sutons.
Yeah, and have a look at the Coral and then, you know, and OMD from over there and all that. And then there's stuff from all over. One of my favourite bands is called China Crisis, and I don't know whether you know them, but really good band. They're from Kirby, where I'm from. So there's great musical heritage in Liverpool. In fact, our first number one, we've had the most number ones of anywhere in the country. Our first number one was Lita Rosa. Do you know what she sang?
No.
How much is that doggy in the window? So, eclectic or whatever, you know, that's a choice of music from the Beatles, the Zootons, with that in the middle.
Well, that doggy would cost a lot more now, of course, thanks to the inflation caused by Putin's invasion of Ukraine and this disastrous 49 days in Downing Street. There must be part of you that, for all of Liverpool's musical heritage, looks at Manchester and thinks, Oasis, the Stone Roses, take that, the Inspiral Carpets, the Smiths, and thinks actually, and I say this to someone from Nottingham, but you must look at Manchester and think, oh, they're probably beaters in the music stakes.
I think anybody can have a decade where they've got good music coming from. Ours has lasted for generations, you know, sea shanties right the way through to what we've got today. You've got some really good bands coming through. There's Red Rum Club, I don't know that you've heard of them, but they're going to be a big band. And there's a few others, Quayside and one or two. But Liverpool is an area that music, genuine music in their DNA. If you have a look at what we did on Eurovision, and me and Andy had banter over this, because Spirit of Manchester went for Eurovision, along with lots of other places, including Glasgow, and we won it. And they chose us, not because we put the most money into the bid, but because genuinely the people here feel it. And anybody who experienced those 10 days, because they had all the build-up and the semi-finals and all this, they left this place and they absolutely universally loved it. And Eurovision said it's the most successful and best Eurovision ever. Well, that's what we've got. And I think there's so much opportunity here to capitalize on those decades, not just a very short window of Madchester.
I was trying to provoke you, Stephen. It hasn't worked. but never mind. So just thinking about what you were doing a third term then. I mean, I know buses are a big deal for Labour and bringing them under public ownership. And there are areas like Nottingham where there's always been a publicly owned bus company. It's not just about trains, which has obviously been announced this week. Do you think then Labour is being more radical? You know, people see Keir Starmer perhaps as a moderate Labour. Some people may even call him a Blairite. Do you think he's prepared to be more radical then, and Labour is more radical than perhaps the public are realising?
Well, the number one goal is to see him walking down Downing Street, isn't it, for everybody. And then it'll be for people like me and others to try to shape what a future Labour government looks like in reality, not, you know, hypothetically what they might do and making all of those promises that we've seen time after time with Tory governments that they've had to roll back on or completely break. So I want to see some pragmatism about policy. But the ones that have been announced just recently, as you just said, I think Lou Hague is brilliant, by the way, but what you want to do on with the National Rail, that's important. But we've already bought our own trains. We've bought £500 million worth of rolling stock in the Liverpool City region. And we borrowed money to do that. But of course, the costs of the old stock were significantly more than the new stock. So over a period, we actually make money back on this. Well, that we can do that as a country as well. You can invest to save. I think there'll be more of those things that are teased out. I'd love us to look beyond just rail nationalisation, but it might take a little bit of time to tease these things out. But that's why we are a broad church. That's why it's so important to still have people from different wings of the party, because if it's all one way, and I think the Tories are going to go very much left to the right, and have a look at what happens with their electoral fortunes. If you don't have that broad range, then you're not representing a huge constituency of people. And that's what our party's always been about.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
You've won two terms. And you've in both of those elections got something like 60% of the vote. Do you, going into May the 2nd, have any doubts that you'll be re-elected? I mean, how much fear does a returning Labour mayor have in a place like Liverpool?
Well, Well, it's a city region, and people forget about, like, Liverpool is very red. But the more you go out, if you do concentric circles, then you'd find that in other places, they very much are still mixed, and there are Tory areas, especially in the Wirral. Southport is still a Tory area with Tory MP, although that looks as if that might change in the forthcoming general election. So it's not that you take things for granted. And I've always believed that Scotland is a salutary lesson for anybody in politics, because if you don't go out and work here, then things can change very, very quickly. And I'm not going to allow that to happen here. So we're out there straight after this. The reason I can't stay much longer is because, well, one, you don't want me to, but two, even if I could, we're going out campaigning, and we've been out every single night for the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks, even in the piddling down rains, pushing papier-mâché through people's letterboxes, which they really love. I'm sure they appreciate the effort that's gone into that, instead of just looking at this mess and thinking that's going straight in the bin. But we'll do everything we can, because it's important that this, what happens here, and there'll be a particularly low turnout, I think, but this set of elections now is a barometer, isn't it? And will be used so by sophologists about what's going to happen in the general election in the next few months. So I want to have a really good result for Labour on the night.
I'm thinking about the party and the leader. What's your relationship like with Keir Starmer?
Well, it's changed, in all honesty, over the last it's about 12 months since Sue Gray came on board, and it might be less than that, but we started to meet on a much regular basis and on a genuinely consultative footprint. So beforehand, you'd sort of be summoned, wouldn't you? And you go down and there'd be a lot of talk. Now it's about how we can demonstrate, and we are, the value of Labour in power, because whilst we've not been in Downing Street, we've been in power in Greater Manchester, Liverpool City Region, lots of other places, Tracy across the way in West Yorkshire. And why don't we publicise the great things that we're already doing, and actually, I think, nullify those attacks from the Tories that, you know, Labour can't be trusted, you know, or business won't trust Labour. Well, do you know what? Speak to the businesses and the ecosystem that were created in the Liverpool City region, and they'll tell you, businesses will tell you, they very, very much value the relationship and the partnership that we've got. So I think we can do a little bit more as a party to tease out some of the great things that are already happening.
So what difference has Sue Gray made?
Oh, very, very different. Don't forget, I not only have seen this from this perspective, I was generally called with PPS, as you well know, even though he knew that I voted for Andy Burnham and I was a Burnham supporter. You know, Andy keeps on reminding me as his campaign manager that it wasn't the raw ingredients of the candidate, but the flaws in the campaign that caused that defeat. Jeremy was somebody who, despite the fact that not supporting him, approached us and said, you know, we want to build this coalition within the party. Would you come on board? And I told you, I love the Labour Party. It's sometimes like an errant child and I want to tell it off, but I still love it. And we said, yeah. So what Sue's done is, what I saw outside, is reconnected those bits and given a much stronger voice for Labour Metro mayors, but also for other people, so that can be fed into the sausage machine, and then hopefully you get better policies by doing that.
Because people from the outside, obviously when she was announced that she was going to come and work for Keir Starmer, it was a big coup given everything that had happened in Downing Street at the time. And then people from the outside might not necessarily know the impact that individuals can have within the system, but it sounds like she's actually had a big impact.
I think so. And if you'd asked all of the other mayors, all the other Labour mayors, and the candidates, by the way, for the mayoralties that are coming up, I think to a man or woman, everyone would say that it's been a real significant change and very welcome change, because we We want to have good relationships with the person that I think most people now believe is going to be the future prime minister of this country. And that's how the machinery can work better together. And of course, you know, when hopefully the election's called and Labour, fingers crossed, are successful, those relationships will be really important, because we want to do things for the party but that are right by our areas. I'll give you an example. We've talked about council housing, haven't we, which I think is a great policy at a national level. Well, who's going to deliver that? Because there are housing revenue accounts that still need to be sorted out, and all of those sort of minutiae need to be sorted at a level where you can get delivery very, very speedily. And that's, I think, through Metro Mayors. So, yeah, it's important, that relationship. And the more it develops and the more trust that is engendered between both sides, I think the better it'll be for everyone.
You mentioned Liverpool's reputation, I guess, or its treatment at the hands of people in power, particularly in London, and people can think of specific things. Obviously, the Thatcher era, and obviously people think of Derek Hatton and stuff, but they also think of Hillsborough, miscarriages of justice on a grand scale. Obviously, Liverpool has had to fight prejudices against it from outside. But what's your assessment of how Liverpool feels about itself?
That's a great question, you know, because I think since 2008, when we had the brilliant Lord Mayor, I mean, the European capital of culture, I think we've started to find that self-confidence again. And look, we've always been a bit chippy, haven't we, as people from this area, and scouts as Liverpoolians. But that's not over self-confidence. It's not arrogance. It's about understanding the place that we're from and the history that is behind that. I mean, if anyone hasn't been to Liverpool and you come here, literally you come here and it blows your socks off. You're like, wow, I didn't realise it's such a beautiful city. It's so well appointed. And then we've got areas outside of Liverpool in the city region, you know, some of the best beaches you'll ever see anywhere, over on the Wirral or down the way in Sefton and in Formby and places like that. There's something for everybody in the Liverpool city region, and that's what we're trying to get over. And the issue is we speak with many accents. So if you go to St. Helens, they'll speak with a certain accent, and then it's different on the Wirral and in Southport. And that. But we speak with one voice now because we've got this devolution agreement, and slowly people are starting to understand what that means and the benefits of it. So I think we're facing, you know, the next term, but beyond that, probably a decade, especially with a Labour government, fingers crossed, of real excitement and not just regeneration, but almost rebirth. You know, we were the lifeblood of the first industrial revolution because of the River Mersey. If I can get my Mersey Tidal project off the shelf and it's oven, it will be oven ready, as somebody once said, by then. But if I can do all of that, we've got digital connectivity here in the ground now. We've built that over the last 6 years. That's the fastest in the whole country. It connects up to the most sophisticated computer in the country in Hartree, the Hartree supercomputer in Halton. And then the fiber optic cables link us with North America. All of the infrastructure is going in that I think is pivotal to the next part of our future, as the likes of canals and railways. Don't forget, we had the first rail system between here and Manchester, and docks. We had the first wet and dry docks. Look, I think that the bits that we're doing now will be looked back on in perhaps 50 years, 100 years time, and people will say, that's where that renaissance started to happen.
And is that the long-term goal then? I remember talking to Andy Street, who's obviously the West Midlands Metro Mayor, a few years ago, and they were talking about wanting the West Midlands to be the home of these lithium batteries for electric cars and really positioning themselves as that. Is it for Liverpool then? Is it a mixture of fiber optic and stuff and high speed, as well as this Tidal project? Are they the sort of long-term job creation schemes for the area?
Well, there's a few. I mean, life sciences, we've got what's called an innovation zone. So we're being identified by UK government as being a hub of innovation. So we want to capitalise on that. But look, the green industrial revolution is upon us, isn't it? It's real, it's happening. And we can become Britain's renewable energy coast with the Tidal project and then all of the other things that we've got. Nobody can compete. And nobody's got all of the individual elements of green energy that we can have. We've got the whole lot. Tick, 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 tick. So what does that mean to our fortunes if we've got green energy and brilliant digital connectivity? And we've got world-class facilities with a quantum computer going in SDFC, and with our advanced computing in the University of Liverpool. So what do all them nice bits mean? It means, for instance, that with AI, we can use that, what we're calling AI for good. In Washington, D.C., when myself and Andy Brenner went over to go to the White House, we talked before about a bricky from Kirby. I went to the White House, you know, not the pub, the actual White House, and they were doing responsible AI, and we got some ideas. And when I've come back, we've already spoken to an organization who are going to trial AI in schools. And it means that our kids will be using the same technology as kids in Eton and Harrow, and we want to pilot it across the whole and city region because of this infrastructure we've got. And it'll give teachers the time to concentrate on doing the job that they should do, which is teaching those kids who need to have that tuition. But the AI stuff, because it's AI, it's tailored to an individual learner. And, you know, in all honesty, I'd love to see kids here who are turned out because of this getting the same opportunities as those kids from Eton and Harrow get. Who knows, we might get a future Prime Minister, a Scouse Prime Minister.
I mean, the opportunities for it are so exciting, particularly, as you say, for social mobility and for all of society to benefit. You mentioned earlier about being designated a hub. What does that mean? Are there tax incentives or things like that?
Yeah, I just on AI, because people will be listening to this and some people will be really fearful of AI. And I think that's right, that we've got to be really cognizant of the guardrails that need to be put in place. So while that's not my responsibility, so whilst they're all being developed, I think we can capitalize on what's happening today, and we want to be leaders in this. So all of that great stuff that might come in the future, health's another one that we want to use AI for, you know, to use wearables, you know, Fitbits and all that. There's a watch that's being developed that'll take, for instance, your blood pressure, lots of other things, and diagnose all stuff. We could use that as well, and that frees up time for doctors then to concentrate on what they need to do. And just imagine if we've got the diagnostics and it tells you, for instance, not to smoke, of course, not to drink, not to eat too much red meat, not to watch Everton. By the way, there's an election on, and you know, if anything, the result the other night reminded me that there are two teams in our city. But an innovation hub will mean for us that we can cluster stuff, and we've carved out, because everyone's going for life sciences, we haven't said we're going to do all of life sciences, it's too broad. So we're going to specialize in certain parts of life sciences, and we've narrowed that down with our universities and some of our NHS providers, including mental health, it must be said, because we believe we can look at non-pharmaceutical interventions as well and develop those for people with mental ill health and well-being issues. So the bits that we're doing, I think we can capitalize on those and grow those, and then obviously monetize those, because we want to be able to increase the revenues here so that we can reinvest that in all the good stuff we want to do.
Just thinking about the politics of the UK, and obviously devolution is one element. There's always been this conversation about a north-south divide. I just wonder, whatever, you know, the proof of that is that maybe that's counter to actually a Labour analysis of history, which would be about class, and that working class people in the East End of London have more in common with working class people in Liverpool than say they do with middle class people in Liverpool or middle class people in London. And is there a risk when politicians talk about the North-South divide and think about it that way, that in a way, firstly, Labour wants to win an election to a parliament that is in the south of England, but it fundamentally goes counter, actually, to Labour philosophy?
Well, it depends whether by doing that you become anti-London, and I've never been anti-London. Obviously, as an MP, I had to live in London, so there are some unbelievable places in London, but you're right, there are some areas that have been left behind and they need some investments as well. But if you have a look at pre-unification Germany, the divide there between West and East was enormous. Do you know that the divide between North and South in England is more pronounced than it was pre-unification in Germany? That's the level of lack of investment that we've had in this country. In fact, if you have a look at where we are politically, we're the most centralised in the whole of Europe, and, well, certainly the OECD, and we have the most imbalance in the economy. And I believe then politically it's about politics, not just about money from central government. It's about providing opportunities for that latent potential really to come to the fore. And we've genuinely never gone to Whitehall or Westminster knocking on the door and saying, can we have a handout? We've gone down and said, if we get this investment, we'll give Treasury a return on that. And we've identified what the multiplier effect would be. I think that's the better way of doing it. And if we could release some of that potential in the north of the country, then just imagine what that does for UK PLC. It's better for everybody.
I remember seeing you on it. It must have been it was a documentary not long after you got elected, where I think you were working on a chimney stack. Is that right? What was that? Was it Channel 4?
Yeah. But it wasn't in the sort of the chitty chitty bang bang style. It wasn't like up the chimney. I was taking a chimney stack down.
Yeah.
I was a bricky, and so we've got an old Victorian house. And I just thought, before I get too decrepit and the arthritis in my fingers prevents me, I'll need to do all the things at a height that I can do now and I won't be able to do when I'm 60 plus, which I am now. So, yeah, I went up and took four stacks down. And they were filming this documentary called Inside the Commons, I think it was called.
That was
Michael
it.
Michael Cobrell.
That's what it was.
And it was a number of people that they picked out. So they phoned me and said, we want to come to Liverpool and do some stuff. And I just said, well, I can't do it. I said, because I'm taking my chimney down. I'm up a scaffold. And they were like, can we come? I said, yeah. And there's a part in it that I'll never forget, because I'm taking this the stack down. But do you know the pot, the clay pot on top, which weighs a couple of hundred pounds? They are really rich, great big thing. And as I'm taking it off, the bit that attaches to it, like a cowl, is called the crown. And it fell. And genuinely, I bottled it. I was going to say some naughty word then. But I just about caught it, like Bruce Grobler. And I said, I've saved the crown. And then they cut from that to the state opening of Parliament about the crown. And it was like joyous for them. We were like, oh, it was well worth coming. I could have killed myself, but it was great for the telly.
So do you still do stuff around the house then? Are you still pretty handy?
All the time. Honestly, I've got stuff on the go at the moment. I want to build an orangery. So I've started to do all of that. And obviously I've got a really strict four person with my wife, who explains to me everything that I'm doing wrong and the fact that it's not happening quick enough. And as I said to her, you know, you're married a builder. when I said that I'd have the house done in, you know, a few years' time, it was only an estimate. I've been there 34 years now, so it's not bad, is it?
No, that some uncharitable people might say that builders and politicians have a lot in common with things running over budget and then and not being delivered on time and not being held to their promises.
Yeah, well, I'm a better politician then than I am a builder, because all of my budgets have been absolutely balanced.
Steve, this has been an absolute pleasure. I would love to interview you again, and all the best.
Thanks, Matt, and all the best to you as well, lad.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. Steve Rotherham standing for a third term on the 2nd of May. And of course, the London mayoralty and various other local authorities are up on the 2nd of May. And I'm one of those sad losers who will be watching television all day on Friday, the 3rd of May, taking in all the results and trying to extrapolate what relatively low turnout elections mean for a general election projected nationwide and all that. So I'll be back next week with another fantastic guest, maybe a couple of episodes, given things that may have already happened in Scotland by the time you listen to this, or indeed may not have. And I'll see you next time. Thank you for all your emails and tweets and messages about everything. It's so nice to be back working and becoming re-obsessed with politics. What a great privilege. I'll see you next time. Ta-ra.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.